We will talk about primitive art, how we collect it and display it, how we describe it and view it, and what it says about our culture. And in fact, get the idea that perhaps it may say even more about our culture than it does about the culture of the places that produce it. And we'll be talking this morning with Sally Price, who is an authority on the art of the Caribbean, and is the author of a book that explores some of these issues. What is primitive art? Is it really primitive? Is it really art? And does it have an art history? And what role it should play in Western museums and galleries? Her book is entitled Primitive Art in Civilized Places, and it is published by the University of Chicago Press. Sally Price has taught anthropology and art history at a number of places, including Johns Hopkins, Minnesota, and Stanford. She has studied aspects of cultural life in communities of Andalusian cork and olive growers, Caribbean fishermen, Mayan corn farmers, and the descendants of rebel slaves in northern South America. She was the co-curator of the exhibit of Afro-American arts from the Suriname rainforest, which was sponsored by the National Endowment for the Humanities and appeared at museums throughout the United States during 1980 and 82. She now makes her home in Martinique, but does occasionally come back to visit the United States, as she is doing now, and spending some time at Stanford. As we talk with Ms. Price about primitive art in civilized places, you are certainly welcome to call in. If you have comments or questions, maybe as you hear us talk, you will start to think about the topic and have some reaction. We'd be very happy to have you take part in the program. And all you have to do to do that is to pick up your telephone and call us. The local number here is 333-9455. We also have that toll-free line, so that no matter where you are listening, you can call in and we'll pay for the call. That's 800-222-9455. Remember, the two are just a little bit different. Locally, 333-WILL and toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Ms. Price, hello.
Hello, how are you?
Good. Thank you very much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
I guess when we start tossing around this word primitive, we will get all sorts of associations with it, and for better or for worse, popular culture provides us with all kinds of images that will go along with that word.
Right, and I think you're correct to put quotation marks around it. It's a little more awkward in speech than in writing, but it's certainly necessary, and I think the word civilized deserves the same treatment because, in a sense, they constitute a contrast set.
Uh-huh. That's what I think. One of the first things that I found myself thinking about it and looking at some of the things you had written is this notion that the way that we respond to these objects really may say more about us, or at least as much about us, than it does about the objects themselves or the people that have made them. There does seem to be, in the way we relate to these things, an implication, and you don't have to dig very far to find it, that if this stuff is primitive, then we, of course, must be very highly evolved. That somehow we use it as a way of feeling a little bit smug about where we are and our ability
I think you're on the right track. Seeing it as something that we use to reflect back on our own position in the world, almost more than a way of looking at other people.
Yeah, and there is also this interesting implication as you look at the sort of art criticism, the kinds of things that are written about these kinds of pieces, that somehow these people don't. That they don't really even know what they've made, that somehow we know better what they have made than they.
That's a very pervasive idea. That some people have gone so far as to say that the object made, say, in Africa, becomes an art object when it hits the shores of Western Europe or the United States, that it's only when it falls under our aesthetic gaze that it becomes an art object. But before that, it's simply something that has been unthinkingly crafted by somebody who hasn't really understood the beauty that was being created.
It's curious that it in fact goes so far that for in a lot of people's minds, that is in the high culture level of things, if you ask them what is primitive art, apparently one of the things that's very important in the definition is that the artist be anonymous. And we have this odd situation where in fact primitive art may be valued more for who owns it than who made it.
Right. That's right. That was one of the interesting things that became clear as I started working with art collectors, both in France and the United States, that the anonymity of the object was, it was more than a lamentable lack in our knowledge. It was part of the excitement of collecting. There was a thrill to having an anonymous object. And a lot of collectors talked about that in a very positive way.
It also seems one starts to wonder about how these pieces have come to be collected, how they end up in private collections and for sale in galleries and in museums. And you have to wonder whether somehow this attitude towards the pieces and the people that produce them may in part have developed to make people feel a little bit better about having stolen this stuff, because in many cases it seems that it really was stolen, either that or people, you know, the creators were offered some very small pittance of money or something else. But it seems that the bottom line is that a lot of this stuff really was stolen. And somehow, if you can say to yourself, well, these people, they don't really know what they've got. They really can't appreciate this stuff. It'll just sit here and rot. But if we take it and bring it to the civilized world and put it in the Metropolitan Museum of Art, it'll be preserved, and people who really can understand and appreciate it can see it. And somehow I can see that operating as a way of making people feel better about having taken this from the people who made it.
Right. It becomes a kind of rescue operation in which we know better than the people who own these objects, and we have better techniques and we have better judgment about preserving these things, so that we're really taking over responsibility for the destinies of objects that maybe in their native state would deteriorate, but as part of a natural life process of art objects, it's a different conceptualization, and there is an arrogance built into it, in that we're saying that we know better than the people who originally made these objects, and we're kind of brushing them aside in order to follow through on our program of preserving and putting into museums and conserving and so on. According to our standards.
Our guest this morning, just mentioned again, is Sally Price. We're talking about her book, Primitive Art in Civilized Places. If you have questions, you'd like to be a part of the conversation, we welcome you in. The number to call locally is 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Where does this kind of thinking come from? Is it an outgrowth of the colonial experience, or does it go back further?
Certainly. In origin, it certainly is. When I started working on this project, I was coming from... I was kind of turning the tables on things that I had done prior to this book. I've been an anthropologist for a long time, and I've been working in different locations trying to understand and then write about a worldview that's different from our own. And in the early 1980s, I started, partly through the exhibit that I was curating on the art of Maroons from Suriname, I started looking at things from the other angle, looking at Westerners envisioning the objects that I had been trying so hard to see from the point of view of their makers. And I realized that there were very strong ideas that were sitting in the heads of people who would walk into a museum about this category that is known in our world as primitive art. And so that was kind of the origin of that. I decided that it would be interesting to try to pinpoint what those ideas were.
Mm-hmm. Well, I did start off mentioning that, you know, that when you use the word primitive, that people will have of a lot of associations with that, some that's supplied by popular culture and some perhaps from whatever kind of educational experience they've had or visits to a museum or whatever. And I wanted to ask about, you know, say we have a popular culture set of associations that go with primitive, but is there a high culture set of associations that go with primitive, or in fact, is there not that much difference between maybe the high culture and the popular culture in the way it views the quote-unquote primitive?
You're asking about people who are sophisticated in the art world, looking at this body of material that that we call primitive, and asking whether their view is different from the popular conception.
Yes.
It's kind of interesting, and one of the things that, when I started working on this whole area, one of the reactions that I got from academics and professionally involved people was, gee, you're looking at stereotypes, you're thinking about misconceptions about this category and so on, but don't touch us because we know better, and are, you know, as scholars, we are more thoughtful about these things and more well-informed and so on. And I took that kind of as a challenge because I saw things that were going on within that very sophisticated academic community that I thought were distorting realities as well. And so, I included members of the French Academy, for example, and people who saw themselves as extremely sophisticated about these things and tried to ferret out the misconceptions that they shared with popular conception as well. And there are quite a few. Another reaction that I had at the beginning was, oh, well, these are things that we have outgrown. We are now beyond the naive point of view to think this and that and other thing and so on, and we now are much more sophisticated than our parents and grandparents and so on, and these are all stereotypes of the past. What I found in exploring further was that the stereotypes are with us today. They're very alive and well, and exist in the professional art world as much as in the popular consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
That there's a real link.
There was one quote that really struck me, and I made note of it, and that you mentioned here, from Kenneth Clark, who is rather well known as a popularizer of art history and has been seen on public television and so forth. This was a quote, and he was talking about apparently comparing with some art from Africa with that of the classical Greeks. And he talks about the two different worldviews, and he apparently, this is from his book, Civilization, A Personal View. He writes, to the Negro imagination, the world is one of fear and darkness, ready to inflict horrible punishment for the smallest infringement of a taboo. To the Hellenistic imagination, it is a world of light and confidence, in which the gods are like ourselves, only more beautiful, and descend to earth in order to teach men reason and the laws of harmony. It's racist. It's terribly racist. And that kind of thinking does seem to come up again and again as people are, you know, they're drawing these comparisons between us and them, between civilized and primitive, between the artists that are producing work now and have produced work in the West, and those that have produced work in the less developed world. And there does, again, you don't seem to have to dig too far to come up against some pretty racist assumptions.
Yeah, that's true. And another, there's a lot of that sort of thing. Another case that, example really, that I used in another point in my new book is E.H. Gombrich, who certainly is one of the stellar figures of the world of art criticism. And talking about, I'm trying to think whether he used the word primitive art. I think he either used the word primitive art or some very close synonym, and he compared and then talked about the arts of Africa more specifically, and compared African artists to children, and said, Negroes in Africa are sometimes as vague as little children about what is a picture and what is real. They even believe that certain animals are related to them in some fairy tale manner. They live in a kind of dream world. It's as if children played at pirates or detectives until they no longer knew where the play acting ended and reality began. But with children, there's always the grown-up world about them, the people who tell them, now don't be so noisy, or it's nearly bedtime. For the savage, and he uses the the word savage, there's no other such world to spoil the illusion. That kind of comment, in the context of books that are extremely widely distributed and by people who are enormously respected, I mean, Gombrich writes for the New York Review of Books and so on, says something about how persistent the need to stereotype people who are unlike ourselves is.
Is that simply that kind of basic psychological process of wanting to somehow find assurance in knowing that there is somebody who you can perceive as being a few steps lower down on the social ladder from you?
Yeah, I don't think it's a social ladder. I think it's more, there's a notion of an evolutionary march toward progress. Mm-hmm. And we, of course, are at the front of that march. We are leading the march. And people, the more unlike us people are, the more they are lagging behind in that march. And there's a, in a sense, it's not a surprising trend or need that we have to do that, but it does create images that don't really reflect well on our sophistication about our own place in the world.
It's interesting to read some of the accounts that you give of some of the art history that has been written by Western scholars of quote-unquote primitive art. And there seems to be this fascinating notion that that the artists really don't know what they're doing, that mm-hmm. that somehow it's tied in with the idea that maybe they think that artists in the West are so conscious of the statement that they are making and the symbols that they are using, and it's a very personal sort of statement, and even though the meaning may be veiled, that it's somehow a much more complex and individual sort of expression. And the idea is that somehow primitive art, that the individual artist is not doing that. That's why right. Perhaps it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter that we don't know who it is.
Right.
One
of the contexts that comes out in is there are fairly frequently exhibitions that place side by side objects of so-called primitive art with objects of so-called modern art. They can both be from the 20th century, but they do fall into those categories. And when you listen to what people say, people coming into a museum and walking through galleries that include these mixtures, it's interesting in that respect. One person was overheard commenting on a Picasso face that had three eyes in it, and it must have been in the Primitivism exhibit in New York in 1984. I can't remember exactly what the context was, but there was a Picasso with three eyes, and it was compared with or set side by side with some kind of, I think it was a mask from what is sometimes called the primitive world, which also had three eyes. And the comment of two women who were walking by was, well, at least Picasso knew what he was doing when he put those three eyes in. I mean, that was the difference. It was the intention of the artist that Picasso was playing with, I mean, that he knew that faces had two eyes, but he was playing artistically with that form, and he was doing things that he was aesthetically responsible for, whereas the primitive artist, the implication went, maybe didn't understand so well what he was doing, or didn't understand that faces had two eyes or whatever. There's a projection of non-intent to the primitive artist that certainly we don't allow for artists mm-hmm. from our own culture.
I guess then one of the questions that comes to my mind is there essentially no difference between the African mask carver and Picasso? Or if there is some difference, what is it?
Are you asking still about intent, or?
Well, I guess maybe I'm thinking of the creative process. That is, as they go about doing what they do, is there really any any important difference between the two of them?
Well, my perspective on that is that you can't really generalize about this generic person that we refer to as the primitive artist.
Mm-hmm.
That if we talk about the artist or artists really in a particular society, then we can say something about how they do or don't differ from Picasso. But that if we throw together Eskimo artists and artists from the Amazonian rainforest and artists from Africa and artists from Aboriginal Australia and so on, and say, does he, as if there were a single generic he involved, differ in the way he produces his art from the way Picasso does, then it seems to me that we're posing an impossible question, because we're merging people who are coming from very different artistic traditions and who are playing out very different ideas about aesthetic thinking and artistic production.
This is Focus 580. It's our telephone talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're talking this morning with Sally Price. She is an anthropologist. She is a particular expert in the culture and art of the Caribbean, and is the author of a book entitled Primitive Art in Civilized Places. It is published by the University of Chicago Press. She makes her home in Martinique, but is occasionally back in the United States and is now having spending some time at Stanford University. The book is basically about our attitudes towards the art of quote-unquote primitive peoples, and what that is and what that says about us and the way we think about our society and our civilization. If you have questions, and we have a couple of folks here to talk with, you can call in. You're welcome to do that. The local number is 333-9455, and the toll-free is 800-222-9455. We have callers here on some of our local lines. We'll start with line one. Hello.
I would appreciate it very much if Ms. Price could talk more about values that we do share, the positive side, do share with these primitive artists, even though ours may be so deep within us that we're not always entirely conscious of it. Now, you touched on this a little in talking about children's art, but couldn't you discuss this a little more fully, please?
Yes, that's a good question. If we think about categories that separate out, let's say, fine art and folk art and popular art and primitive art, and if we find problems in those categories, it seems to me that we have two possible choices. We can either, and now I'm talking about the primitive art section of that, we can either say, let's be more specific. Primitive art is a category that doesn't make sense. Let's break it down into the pieces of it that really make sense to talk about. Let's talk about art from this society or that society or whatever and make finer distinctions. Or we can move in the opposite direction. And we can say, let's forget about categories like fine arts, primitive art, popular art, and so on, and let's talk about art as a phenomenon across the board. And I think that's what, as I understand your question, that is what you're asking toward.
Yes, I want to know, talk less about category and all, but more about what are some of these values or concepts of the nature of the universe and so forth, the positive things. You keep discussing the categories and you don't get at what's the reality behind them.
Well, I think once we understand how poorly constructed those categories are, then we free ourselves to look at art in its own terms and for what it is. If we can look at art without placing it in this category, primitive art that has very strong racist connotations, it has all kinds of problems that kind of haunt us as we talk about it. That once we understand what those problems are and can kind of circumvent the need to have that category, then I think you're right. Then we can talk about art for its own value.
Well, but couldn't you do that right now?
Well, tell me specifically what
you found out. Certain particular basic attitudes toward the nature of the universe, or human nature, that were common to a so-called primitive man and for us right today. And of course, in a sense, that shows up in the children's art, but it probably persists in the attitudes and feelings of adults, too. Where are the similarities?
Yeah, the difficulty that I'm having in responding to that question is that, in one way, it's a whole library of literature. You're asking about art in its most massive incarnation.
No, I'm trying to talk about the religious and the basic concepts behind the art that leads people to create it, the longing within the person, which
people
are involved.
Part of the argument that I have presented in my book is that those aspects of art are not more specially developed in what we call primitive art than they are in other kinds of art, and that the notion that so-called primitive art has something stronger in common with, say, children's art is an unjustified but very popular conception, that the arts that I have known firsthand, and I'm coming at this problem really from fairly intensive work with particular societies, artists that I have known from the so-called primitive world are very sophisticated people. And they think aesthetically in very sophisticated ways. They're conscious of their art history and so on. And it's not that they are approaching art in some kind of direct way that makes their artistic production more like children's art. So I think that tie, if they were to be conceived of as being stronger in primitive art than in Western art, is a fallacious.
Well, I'm sorry. I just do not seem to be able to convey to you what I mean, but thank you very much. Anyway, this is a very interesting program.
Okay,
thank you.
I appreciate the call. Let me just, let me try. I think what the caller was trying to get at was, are there universals in human experience that are expressed in art created by all peoples, all places, at all times? Now, and with that, it may be that we're back to your huge library of.
Okay, I guess there are two things to say about that.
Okay.
One is, sure. I mean, insofar as we define art as a category, there are things that pertain to it in any setting, and in children's art, in the arts of other people, the arts of our own society, and so on. There are aesthetic concerns in terms of symmetry, form, bounce. Use of color and so on that go across the board. As an anthropologist, I have a particular interest in the diversity of cultural expression, mm-hmm. more than in the universality of mm-hmm. cultural expression. So that's a personal prejudice of my own. It's not a prejudice, it's a personal... That is something that I have chosen to investigate in more detail than others. There are very strong traditions in our society that have to do with what is universal about artistic expression. And one way that anthropological materials feed into those ideas about the universality of artistic expression is a popular conception that so-called primitive people are somehow in more direct touch with some kind of primal feelings that the way children are, that we in the West have overlaid those feelings with all kinds of civilized noise, and that primitives are closer to their roots, psychologically speaking, and that comes out in their art. And that is an idea that I absolutely reject on the basis of quite a bit of research that I do not find that that's a justified conception. It's a very attractive one. It's an idea that Leonard Bernstein, people like that, are strive to find and to confirm, because it somehow is it has an attraction for us to see the primal truth of people who we like to think of as simpler than ourselves. But I think it doesn't do credit to the sophistication of people in other societies.
Mm-hmm. Well, I have another caller here to talk with. Let's do that. We'll go to line number two. Good morning.
Good morning. I have a question just right at the outset. When the program began, I was sort of making the assumption that primitive art was referring to, for lack of a better word, ancient art. But is that a misconception I have now? Is she also talking about stuff that's being produced today?
Yes. Primitive art is such a funny term because it's been used in all kinds of different ways.
Right.
But a lot of the, if you look at books whose titles are primitive art, of which there are quite a number, there is a merging of art from the Stone Age forward, but it includes a lot of work that's 19th and 20th century. It's not really temporally defined so much as defined by cultural context. In most cases, if we take that as the criterion, if we say, you know, what's in books about primitive art, there are articles in which people talk to the artists who are producing and so on. I mean, it's not there's an implication of pushing it back in time just because of the evolutionary scale that's kind of implied in the category, but it doesn't, in fact, deal with the arts of people who are long gone.
Right. Well, you know what's interesting is that I think you're probably right about the angle that you're taking on the sort of implied. Oh, I don't know. I guess racism is the right word, or culturalism, or something. I think it's there. I don't think I've ever really felt it much, but I had a very interesting experience. The guest won't relate to this probably, but there's a museum at the University of Illinois called the Cranard Art Museum.
Yes, I've been there.
Well, I was downstairs with my wife a few months ago, going through. I don't know what they call it, but for lack of a better term, the primitive art room. And I turned and I saw this mask, and I immediately connected with Picasso. And the interesting thing is that I did not have the response of the ladies you described at the other museum. I went, oh my God, this is incredible. Look, I mean, you know, in fact, also the embarrassing thing is, and I will admit this, that I actually did say to my wife, you know, my God, this is incredible. And then I said, is this new? Was this made here? I mean, which does, I guess, say that actually maybe, you know, I do have that undercurrent that you're talking about of Leon. It's almost a disbelief. And what I had a tendency to do, art is sort of a hobby with me. You know, my wife and I are sort of small-time collectors and things, and we enjoy going to the different shows and things. But the primitive room, it always just kind of put me off. I just never, you know, wandered around in it much for no good reason. But that one day we went in there, and then it opened my eyes that this was art. It's exactly what you're saying. I don't have to judge it by some art, it's by some fabricated standard. All I have to do is open my eyes and look at it, and it's amazing. The other thing I wanted to say was, in this room there were some very, very old objects. And what amazed me, my wife and I both, was, there's things like from Egypt that were just like, you know, I mean, I expected them to be sort of crude, and they weren't. They were incredibly beautiful. And
yeah.
I think that people sort of get this idea that, you know, I think we have an idea that is different than the reality of the objects.
Yes, I think that's certainly true, and you're absolutely right. I mean, some of it is crude looking, some of it is extremely refined. There's all the variety in the world, in this stuff that we put in galleries that we label primitive.
May I ask you a question? Out of curiosity, and this is just really, I could look it up in a book, I suppose, but I have noticed a lot of similarity between many Picasso's items and, you know, sketches and sculptures and whatever, and, you know, the quote-unquote, some primitive art. Was he explicitly influenced by any of that, or is this just, I mean, do you happen to know, or was...
Well, I can tell you what you should read about that, because there was a very good... exhibit and tremendous catalog produced in 1984 It was an exhibit that caused a tremendous controversy. Are you already aware of an exhibit that was called Primitivism in 20th Century Art?
That rings a bell, but I didn't.
Okay, it would be what to read. There's a two-volume catalog. The show is over. It was put up in 1984, and I think it traveled into 85. But the catalog is still available. It was done by the Museum of Modern Art in New York. The principal curator was William Rubin, who is an art historian, not an anthropologist. And the idea of that show was to bring together 20th century art that was, in some senses, influenced by some kind of what we call primitive art. And Rubin himself is an expert on Picasso, and he did the chapters on Picasso and also the introduction to the volume, and discussed at great length and with lots of examples the kinds of ties that were there, and tried really to establish what actual pieces Picasso had seen at what points in his career, when he, for instance, before he painted the Demoiselle d'Avignon, which incorporated African mask figures, what African masks had he access to, and what had he had to say about them, and so on. So it's a very specific attempt to trace those ties. I have criticized that exhibit for things that it did, for assumptions that it made about typology and primitive art. But in a sense, that was nitpicking. The scholarship that went into that exhibit and catalog was enormous. And if you wanted to start looking at those kinds of things, it's a good place to start.
Well, thank you very much. And, well, I really enjoy the show, and I'm just going to hang up and listen.
Great. Well, thank you for the call. We have about 10 minutes left. We're talking with anthropologist Sally Price about some of the ideas in her book, Primitive Art in Civilized Places. And if you have questions, comments, you can give us a call, 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. I'm trying to get an understanding of what you think about this notion of the universality of art. Some people, you know, make this argument that if you look at any art object, that somehow, because it was created by a human being, and human beings have much the same set of experiences in life, that if you approach it with an open mind and try to experience it for what it is, that it will kind of speak to you. And the reason it speaks to you is that there is this kind of common bond among humans about through their life experience, you know. And some people make this argument that if you approach primitive art and you really open yourself up to it, that the stuff in it, what it's about, will be very evident. Is there anything to that idea, or is that really a mistaken notion, you think?
It has long been a very attractive image in our way of thinking. If you think back to the 1950s, when there was an exhibition called The Family of Man, and Carl Sandburg wrote an introduction to that, and there was an image created in that exhibition and book, and of sort of joyous brotherhood. And art is one of the ways that kind of universal brotherhood is seen to be expressed. There are problems, it seems to me, when we think about our own reaction to art in that context. There's the idea that by looking at an object, we can, we can work through our most basic aesthetic response and see that art for what it means. And in doing that, we're kind of sidestepping all the cultural assumptions that exist both in our own heads, our own response to art, it seems to me, is affected by the specificities of our cultural experience. And also there are an equally complex set of cultural specificities specificities in the head of the artist who created that work, and we're kind of brushing all that aside and saying, this object can speak to me directly and through the universal language of brotherhood and so on. And that gets into a lot of, it sidesteps a lot of important aspects of aesthetic experience, I think, on both ends of the communication.
Well, we have some other folks to talk with. Let's go to line number one. Hello.
Yeah, hi. It's a complicated sort of a discussion, and you're raising such interesting issues. I just jotted down some things and maybe can comment on it. How about the acceptability of the term non-Western art? First?
Well, yeah, one thing that's interesting about all these terms is that they tend to be, I mean, the definitions of this category that we're going to get at here tend to be negative. And
well, I don't mean it to be. I mean,
no, I mean, a non-Western means things that are not Western. I don't mean negative, pejorative. I mean negative, and it's saying what it isn't. And that leaves open everything that it is.
What would you use?
Well, I gave a talk a couple of days at Stanford, which I argued for a longer time than I have on this program today, that the problem is not finding a correct term for this kind of art. People talk about, they say, we don't like primitive, let's ethnic art, or we don't like ethnic art, let's talk about tribal art, or we like tribal art, let's talk about non-Western art, and so on. There are long discussions that raise problems about all those terms, but as I see things, I would rather not search for a term, because I think the whole category is one that throws us off in a wrong on a wrong path. I think the very undertaking of throwing together the arts of people who are so different from each other is what's wrongheaded about it. I'd rather not give that set of things any kind of defining term, because I don't think they're unified in the experience that's being expressed. In other words, I would either like to talk about art in a universal way, or I would talk about Inuit art, or
rune
art, or so on. But putting all those things together gets us into generalizations that don't deserve to be made.
Okay. Well, here's some of the other. That's very good answer. I have some other questions that came up. Maybe there's not time. I wondered about patronage, the idea of art in museums and private collections, which you talked about in terms of your book, and how art collectors today are doing this. The idea also of art out of context. In Western art, our idea of having art on walls, art on in galleries, in museums, for sale, whereas oceanic art or African art or the other arts you're talking about, I think of as more in terms of function, religious function, decorating canoe handles, putting gods on. In other words, in maybe just temporary art, using very tentative temporary kinds of material which are not meant to last, are not meant to be put up to be savored and looked on as aesthetic objects. So that itself, and the whole idea of the distinctions between anthropology and art, which I see is, I think, an important issue. So it sort of comes down to those three.
Yeah, you're asking very good questions and very enormous ones. And I would say, just because our time is a little bit limited, that I have discussed them at greater length in my newest book. I don't exactly know how to respond to them in such a short time, but the question of distinguishing art and anthropology and so on is a tremendously important one, and one that people are debating with a lot of sensitivity now. There was an exhibit in New York at the Center for African Art that was called Art Artifact, and it attempted to show, to explore the differences in how art is presented in the context of a museum, which is one piece of what you're asking about, as I understand it. The title of that catalog was Art, all in capital letters, and then a slash, and then Artifact in lowercase letters, because there is a hierarchical implication in that categorization. But it tried to show different ways that museums could present art as art or as anthropology, as art or artifact, that sort of thing. People are thinking in interesting ways about that problem now. I didn't take notes on the beginning of your
The whole idea of that you're talking now about. I talked about art in context and the whole idea of patronage.
And patronage, right? Ah.
Well, I just wonder about the modern collector and this kind of thing that you talked about in the very beginning. To expand on that, it's a little late.
Yeah, there are a whole lot of things to say about that. One of the phenomena that I found interesting in talking to collectors, and the work that I did for this book was mainly done it was done a lot in France and also in the United States. I was living in Paris at the beginning of doing the research for this book, and I got to know collectors on both sides of the Atlantic. One of the things that was interesting about art collecting to me, it was a whole new world when I started exploring it, was how objects are really taken totally into that world, and that their birth in other societies is essentially eradicated from the record. That that when an African mask comes into collecting circles in Paris or New York or wherever, that the artist who made it and the society that originally nurtured it or owned it or gave meaning to it, tend among collectors to be kind of brushed under the rug. And that's why when you look at such objects in museum displays, for example, the name that you see on the museum label is the name of the collector or the owner, sometimes even with the name of someone who it's shown in honor of or in memory of or whatever. But they are Western names, and it's very rare that the original life history of that object is recognized. I mean, it's a total takeover of not only the object, but of its life history and of its aesthetic meaning, really.
We're going to have to stop, and I'm really very sorry. I wish that we had more time. There are many other areas of this topic that we could explore, and we're just unfortunately going to have to leave it at that. However, Ms. Bryce, I certainly want to thank you very much for talking with us, and also to suggest to people, if they would like to read more on this topic, they will take a look at the book Primitive Art in Civilized Places. It's published by the University of Chicago Press. And thank you very much for talking with us. It's been quite interesting.
It was my